This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Greetings, I am Barry. If you're searching for answers, spiritual help, clairvoyant readings, healings, crystals, books, incense, or jewellery, you need to go to Infinity, Hamilton Spiritual Centre, in the new premises at 550 Anglesey Street. Or you can phone us on 838 1838. This is your link between this life and the next. Become the change the world needs today.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me calling you? Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me calling you?
The Voice Within, your connection between this world and the next. Brought to you by Infinity Spiritual Center, 550 Anglesey Street, Hamilton.
Greetings, I'm Barry. We continue our story of Michel Demarque and his abduction to the ninth planet. Now we're going to find out about Jesus.
Who was Christ? This occurred during the time of the Pharaoh Seti I. It was a time when the people of Earth had all become materialistic. In Egypt, it was common in high society to take drugs, likewise, in Greece. Fornication with animals was by no means rare, something which is absolutely contrary to nature and universal law. Our mission being to help when it was deemed necessary, we decided to change the course that history was taking, by intervening at this point. We had to get the Hebrews out of Egypt, for they could no longer evolve as a free people while under the evil domination of the Egyptians. It was decided to send a man, capable and just, to lead the Hebrews from Egypt and back to the land they had occupied previously, that is, soon after their arrival on Earth. On the planet Naxiti, a planet of the eighth category, a man by the name of Zioxton had just died. His astral body was waiting to be reincarnated on Thauuba, when it was put to him, that instead, he might be the liberator of the Hebrews. He agreed to this and went to Earth as Moses. Moses, then, was born in Egypt of Egyptian parents. His father was the equivalent of a sub-lieutenant in the army. Moses was not born a Hebrew, that is yet another error in the Bible. The story of the little Hebrew baby set adrift in the water and rescued by a princess is very romantic, but incorrect. What a shame, I always loved that story. It's quite wonderful, like a fairy story. Fairy tales are indeed very pretty, Michel, but you must concern yourself with the truth, not fantasy. Promise me that you will only report what is the truth? Of course, have no fear, thou, your instructions will be followed to the letter, so to speak. I was explaining then, that Moses was born in an Egyptian, military family. His father's name was Lithotes. Until the age of 10, Moses played often with the Hebrew children. A pretty and amiable child, he was popular with the Hebrew mothers who indulged him with offerings of sweets. In turn, they won his heart and he came to love his Hebrew friends like brothers. This is why he was incarnated, of course, but you must realize that, after having seen his life as Moses flash before him, and, after accepting to live that life, all details of it were erased from his memory. He passed through what certain Nagas have called the River of Oblivion. This happens whether one accepts or rejects a possible reincarnation. Of course, there is a reason for it. If, for example, you remembered that, around 40 years of age, you would lose your wife and two cherished children in a car accident and that you, yourself, would be confined to a wheelchair, the knowledge could tempt you to take your life rather than face up to your troubles, or it might lead you to behave badly in other spheres. So, the film, is erased, in something like the way you, wipe out, a tape recording. Occasionally, by accident, the machine does not erase everything and you can hear brief portions of what should have been erased. Of course, my analogies are fanciful when I speak of films, and, tape recordings, but I hope they give you an idea of what I am trying to explain. In reality, the process involves electrophotonics, which mean nothing, yet, to people on Earth. This, in fact, occurs often in the films that the higher self shows to an astral body, which is why most people say, on several occasions in the course of their lives, I have seen that before, or I have heard that before, and they know what the very next action or word will be. In English, people call this feeling déjà vu. Yes, I understand well what you are saying. The strangest such experience that I have had was when I was in French Equatorial Africa. I was in the army and we were on maneuvers about 600 kilometers from base. We were approaching the Chad border and I was standing with other soldiers in the back of a troop carrier facing the road. Suddenly, I recognized the road as if I'd been there just a fortnight before. I was as though hypnotized by this stretch of road that ended with a right-angled bend. I recognized the road, however, I was also sure that, around the bend, I was going to see a little straw hut, all by itself, sheltered by a mango tree. I was increasingly convinced that such would be the case and, when the truck took the bend, there it was, a lone straw hut beneath a mango tree. And then it was over, I recognized nothing more. My face turned white. My nearest companion asked me if I was feeling all right, and I explained what had happened. His response was, "You must have come here as a kid." I knew that my parents had never set foot in Africa, but I still wrote to them, so strongly had the experience affected me. Their reply was, "No, and you never left us to make any such accompanied journeys when you were little." So, my friend suggested that I might have gone there during a previous existence, for he was a believer in reincarnation. What do you think of that? It's what I've just explained to you, Michelle. Quite a long segment of your film was not erased for you, and I'm glad, for it illustrates very well what I was explaining to you in regard to Moses. He wanted to help the Hebrews, but, as he chose to enter that world by the usual means, as a newborn baby, he was obliged to forget what the course of his life would be. However, in rare cases such as this one, the astral body is so charged with knowledge and experience from previous lives that it has no trouble adapting to what it must learn in its new physical body. Moses was also advantaged in that he was sent to a good school with numerous facilities. He was enormously successful in his studies and gained entry into a much higher school of science, headed by priests and Egyptian experts. At this time, the Egyptians still had high schools which catered for a very limited elite, teaching some of the learnings Thoth brought from Atlantis a long time previously. He was near finishing his studies, when he was witness to an incident that had great significance in his life. Still feeling great friendship towards the Hebrews, he often walked with them, despite the urgent recommendations of his father not to do so. The Hebrews were becoming increasingly despised by the Egyptians, and his father advised Moses not to mix with this race. Nevertheless, on this day he was walking in the vicinity of a building site where Hebrews were working under the directions of Egyptian soldiers. From afar he saw a soldier hit a Hebrew, who fell to the ground. Before he could intervene, a group of Hebrews threw themselves on the soldier and killed him, then they buried him quickly in foundations being made to hold an enormous column. Moses didn't know what to do, but he was seen by a couple of the Hebrews as he moved away. Believing he would denounce them, the Hebrews panicked and hastened to spread the word that it was Moses who had killed the soldier. When he arrived home, his father was waiting for him and advised him to go, immediately, into the desert. The Bible story that he went to the country of Madian is true, as is the report of his marriage to the daughter of the priest of Madian. I am not going to elaborate further on the details. We wanted to save these people from the slavery into which they'd fallen and, worse, from the clutches of evil priests who were a danger to their psyche. More than a million years earlier, we had saved another group of people from the hands of other dangerous priests, if you recall, and, interestingly, it was in practically the same location. Do you see how history is just a perpetual recommencement? Moses led the Hebrews from Egypt much as it is described in the Bible, but before proceeding, I must rectify certain errors, since we know that many people on earth are greatly interested in this famous Exodus. First of all, the Pharaoh at the time was Ramses II, who was successor to Seti I. Next, the Hebrews numbered 375,000 and, when they arrived at the Sea of Reeds, and not the Red Sea, our spaceships, numbering 3, opened the waters, which were quite shallow, by means of our force field. We allowed the waters to close again, but not a single Egyptian soldier drowned, simply because they hadn't followed the Hebrews into the water. The Pharaoh, in spite of enormous pressure from the priests, did not retract his promise and let the Hebrews leave. The manna, distributed every day, came from our spacecraft. I must explain to you that manna is not only very nourishing, as you know, but also very compactable, which is why many spaceships carry it on board. However, if you leave manna too long exposed to the air, it becomes soft and rots within 18 hours. That's why we recommended that the Hebrews take only as much as they needed for each day, and those who took more soon saw they had made a mistake and that they should have followed the advice of the Lord God, who was actually us. The Hebrews did not take 40 years to reach Canaan, but only 3.5 years. Lastly, the story of Mount Sinai is almost true. We landed on the mountain so as not to be seen by the people. It was preferable at the time, for these simple people to believe in a God, rather than in extraterrestrials who watched over them and helped them. So that is the explanation of the Hebrew people, Michel, but it isn't finished. In our eyes, these were the only people who followed the right direction, that is, the direction of spirituality. Among them, and, later, among their great priests, there were some who rumored that a Messiah was going to come and save them. They should not have told the people that, for they were reporting a part of the conversation we had with Moses on Mount Sinai. Since then, the Hebrews have been waiting for the arrival of the Messiah, and yet, he has already come. Let's now jump in time. The Hebrews, back again in the land they had originally settled, were now better organized. They established a civilization notable for great royal legislators such as Solomon and David, to name but two. We observed that these people, following Solomon's death, were heading towards anarchy and allowing themselves to be influenced by evil priests. Alexander the Great invaded Egypt but, in the end, did nothing constructive for the world. The Romans succeeded him, building an immense empire that was oriented more towards materialism than spirituality. The great peoples, such as the Romans, were technologically advanced for their time, relatively speaking, of course. But they brought with them a smattering of gods and beliefs, just enough to cause spiritual confusion, and, certainly, not enough to lead the people to universal truth. This time, we decided to give a big hand. Rather than give it in a spiritually sterile land like Rome, we did it in Israel, thinking that the Hebrews were very intelligent, having ancestors who were spiritually highly advanced. We considered them adequate to propagate universal truth. The Hebrew people were unanimously elected by the great Thawri. On earth, they were referred to as the chosen people, and the name could not be more appropriate, they were indeed chosen. Our plan was to capture public imagination by sending a messenger of peace. The story of the birth of Jesus, as you know it, with the Virgin Mary as mother, is quite true. The appearance of an angel at the Annunciation is correct in every detail. We sent a spaceship and one of us appeared before the Virgin, who was indeed a virgin, telling her she was going to become pregnant. The embryo was implanted in her while she was under hypnosis. I see, Michel, you are having enormous difficulty believing what I have been saying. Never forget that we have the knowledge, you have not seen 1/10 of what we can do. Attend carefully and I will give you a few examples to help you understand what I'm going to tell you. Thou stopped talking and appeared to be concentrating. As I watched, her face became a blur and, instinctively, I rubbed my eyes. Of course, this did not help and, in fact, she became progressively transparent until I could see right through her. Finally, she was no longer there, she had completely disappeared. Thou, I called, slightly concerned, where are you? Here, Michel. I jumped, for the voice came as a whisper, quite close to my ear. But you are completely invisible. Now, yes, but you are going to see me again. Look, my goodness, what has happened to you? Several feet in front of me, I saw the silhouette of Thou, completely golden yet radiant, as though inside her there burned a fire, its flames brief but intense. As for her face, it was recognizable but her eyes seemed to send forth little rays each time she spoke. She began to rise a few feet above the ground, without having moved a muscle of her body, then she started to circle the room, so fast I had trouble keeping my eyes on her. She stopped, eventually, above her seat and sat her ghostly form down. It was as though she were made of a shining mist, she was still recognizable as Thou and yet, quite transparent. The next instant she was gone. I looked around, but she had completely vanished. Look no further, Michel, I am back. Indeed, there she was, in flesh and bone again, sitting on her seat. How do you do that? As I was just explaining to you, we have the knowledge. We can revive the dead, cure the deaf and the blind, make people walk who are paralyzed, we can cure any malady you care to name. We are masters, not of nature, but in nature, and we can do the thing most difficult of all, we can generate life spontaneously. Out of the release of cosmic ray, we can create any type of living creature, including man. You mean that you have mastered the test tube baby? Not at all, Michelle. You reason like an earthling. We can create a human body, but that is done only by the great Thauri, taking infinite care, for the human body must be inhabited by several bodies, as you are aware, the physiological, the astral, etc. If not, it would merely be a robot. Perfect knowledge is therefore required for such an undertaking. So, how much time do you need to create a baby? You have not quite grasped what I am saying, Michelle. I am speaking, not of a baby but, in this case, of an adult human being. A man of 20 or 30 years of age can be created by the Thauri in approximately 24 of your Earth hours. As one might expect, I was completely stunned by this disclosure. I had traveled in a spaceship at a speed several times that of light and had found myself billions of kilometers from my home. I had met extraterrestrials, traveled in astral body, journeyed in time to witness scenes that occurred thousands of years ago. I could now see auras and understand languages I'd never heard before. I had even visited, briefly, Earth's parallel universe. I thought I knew what there was to be known, by an earthling, of these people and their capabilities, thanks to the explanations given to me. Now, it seemed I was being told that what I'd been presented with was like an hors d'oeuvre. My hosts could create a living human being in 24 hours. Thou was watching me, reading me like an open book. Now that you follow my meaning, Michelle, I'll finish the story which is going to interest so many of your fellow men, insofar as the Bible has distorted it a little. So, our angel implanted an embryo, so that Mary, a virgin, found herself pregnant. By acting in this way, we hoped to attract the attention of the people and emphasize that the coming of Jesus was really a remarkable event. On the birth of the child, we appeared before the shepherds in the same way that I demonstrated a few moments ago. We didn't send the three famous wise men, they are part of the legend that has been grafted on to real events. However, we did guide the shepherds and a group of the people towards the spot where Jesus was born. This was accomplished by sending forth one of our spheres and rendering it luminous. The optical effect thereby created, made it, indeed, resemble a star over Bethlehem. Nowadays, if we were to do such a thing, people would be crying, UFO. Eventually the priests, and those whom the priests named prophets, learned of the birth. In view of the phenomena of the star and the angels, the prophets announced to the people, the birth of the Messiah, referring to him as the King of the Jews. King Herod, however, had spies in all quarters, as most leaders do. When they reported these remarkable events to him, he found it all difficult to understand and became frightened. In those times, the lives of the people were worth little to their leaders, and Herod had no qualms about ordering the deaths of 2,606 babies in the region. While these deaths were being carried out, we evacuated, under hypnosis, Mary, Joseph and the baby Jesus, as well as two donkeys, in our spaceship, depositing them in a spot quite close to Egypt. Do you see how the facts have been distorted? Now, there are other details which were reported conscientiously, but they are inaccurate due to lack of information. Let me explain. The baby Jesus, born in Bethlehem, proved, by the miracles pertaining to his birth, that he was quite special and was, in fact, the Messiah. So, we had captured the imagination of the people, but, when a baby is born, its astral body cannot know all in regards to its previous knowledge. This was the case of Moses too, and yet he was a great person. We required a messenger who would be able to persuade humanity that there was another life beyond this one, through reincarnation of the astral body, etc. This was no longer commonly accepted since civilization on Earth had become more and more degraded following the disappearance of Atlantis. You know that, when you want to explain something that is not a material fact, even to your closest friends, you are confronted by skepticism. People seek material proof and, if they don't see it with their own eyes, they won't believe. In order to transmit our message, we needed someone who behaved like an extraordinary being, like someone coming from the heavens, who performed what would appear to be miracles. Such a person would be believed and his teachings would be listened to. As you know, an astral body being reincarnated as a baby, passes through the river of oblivion, and his earlier material knowledge is effaced. Therefore, the child born in Bethlehem would not have been able to perform miracles even if he lived to 100 years of age. However, he was a superior being, like Moses. This is proven, by the way he astonished temple doctors at the age of 12. Like the very young people now on earth, who are called geniuses because they seem to have a calculation in their heads, Jesus was a human being inhabited by a highly evolved astral body. And yet, even if he had studied in the very advanced schools on earth, amongst the Nagas, for example, he never could have acquired the knowledge to revive the dead or cure the sick. I know that, on earth, there are people who believe that, from the age of 12, until his return to Judea, Jesus studied in the monasteries of India and Tibet. This is how they try to explain the gap that exists in the Bible, when Jesus simply disappeared from Bethlehem. He left his parents' home at the age of 14, accompanied by his 12-year-old brother Ariki. He traveled to Burma, India, China and Japan. His brother accompanied Jesus everywhere, until Ariki was accidentally killed in China. Jesus took a lock of Ariki's hair with him, for he loved him very much. Jesus was 50 years of age when he arrived in Japan, where he married and had 3 daughters. Finally, he died in the Japanese village of Shingo, where he had lived for 45 years. He was buried in Shingo, which is on the main island of Japan, Honshu, and beside his tomb is another, containing the little box holding Ariki's lock of hair. Those of your fellow men who like evidence can go to Shingo, formerly known as Harai, in the district of Aomori. But let's go back to our precise mission in this regard. The only messenger we could send to earth had to be one of us. The Christ, who died on the cross in Jerusalem, was called Arioch. He was brought by us, to the desert of Judea, having volunteered to change his physical body. Thus, he abandoned his hermaphrodite body, which had lived some considerable time on Thauba, and took on the body of Christ, created for him by our Thauri. By so doing, he maintained totally, the knowledge he possessed on Thauba. Why couldn't he have remained in his body and simply reduced it in size, as Latoli and Biastra did, in front of me? Couldn't he have stayed long enough in a shrunken body? There was another problem, Michel, he had to resemble a human being from Earth in all respects, and, since we are hermaphrodites, we couldn't risk the Hebrews noticing that this messenger from God was half-female. We can regenerate a body at will, which is why you have seen so few children on Thauba. We can also create a body, as I have just explained, and we can reduce it in size. Don't look at me like that, Michel. I realize that it is difficult for you to assimilate all this and to believe what I tell you, but we have already revealed enough for you to know that we are capable of mastering most natural phenomena. Jesus, who came from Thauba, was taken by us into the desert, and you know what followed. He knew that he would come up against numerous difficulties and that he was going to be crucified. He knew all, for he had previewed his life with us, but he had done so as an astral body in a physical body. He remembered, just as you will remember and will always remember your journey to Mu and the glimpses of your previous lives. The visions, I repeat, seen by astral bodies in physical bodies are not erased in the way that visions seen by astral bodies with the higher selves are. Thus, he knew all and knew exactly what to do. Of course, he had the power to resuscitate the dead, cure the blind and the deaf, and, when he was crucified and dead, we were there to take him away and revive him. We rolled the stone from the tomb, quickly took him to our spacecraft which was positioned nearby and, there, revived him. At the right moment, he appeared again, thereby providing his immortality, showing that there was, indeed, life after death, and regenerating hope among the people by persuading them that they did belong to the Creator and that each of us possesses a spark of his divinity. So, all his miracles were performed in order to prove that what he preached was true? Yes, because the Hebrews and the Romans would never have believed him if he hadn't proven himself. There was a very good example of the strength of skepticism among people on Earth regarding the Shroud of Turin. Although millions believe in the coming of Jesus and practice, more or less, Christian religions, they were anxious to hear the results of research by experts, into whether or not the shroud covered Christ after his death. You now know the answer to this. However, people seek proof and more proof, and still more proof, for doubt still exists in their minds. Buddha, an earthling, who acquired his understanding through his own study, did not say, as your fellow men do, I believe, but rather, I know. Faith is never perfect, but knowledge is. When you return to Earth and tell your story, the first thing you will be asked is for evidence. If we were to give you, for example, a piece of metal which doesn't exist on Earth, there would always be one, among the experts who analyze it, who would insist that you prove the metal was not created by a clever alchemist of your acquaintance, or some such thing. Will you give me something as proof? Michelle, don't disappoint me. You will have no material proof, for precisely the reasons I have just outlined, there would be no point. Faith is nothing in comparison with knowledge. Buddha knew, and when you return to Earth, you too, will be able to say, I know. There is a well-known story of doubting Thomas who wanted to touch Christ's wounds, for, seeing them with his own eyes did not convince him enough, and yet, when he touched them, he was still doubtful. He suspected some kind of magic trick. You know nothing of nature on your planet, Michelle, and, as soon as something occurs which is a little beyond your understanding, everyone claims it is magic. Levitation equals magic, invisibility equals magic, and yet we are only applying natural laws. Rather, you should say, levitation equals knowledge and invisibility equals knowledge. So, Christ was sent to Earth to preach love and spirituality. He had to contend with people who were not highly evolved, speaking to them in parables. When he tipped over the merchants' tables at the temple, angry for the first and only time, he was making a statement against money. His mission was to impart a message of love and goodness, love one another, and also to enlighten the people in regard to the reincarnation of astral bodies and immortality. This was all distorted by priests in the time that followed, and numerous disagreements led to the rise of the many sects which claim to follow the teachings of Christ. Christians, throughout the centuries, have even killed in the name of God. The Inquisition was a good example, and the Spanish Catholics in Mexico behaved worse than the most savage tribes, all in the name of God and Christ. Religions are a veritable curse on your planet, as I have said, and as I have proved. As for the new sects that are springing up and flourishing all over the world, they are based on control by brainwashing. It is terrifying to see young people, healthy in body and spirit, throw themselves at the feet of charlatans claiming to be gurus and great masters, when the latter are masters of only two things, talking and collecting fabulous sums of money. This, of course, gives them power and enormous pride to see themselves dominating entire crowds of people who submit to them, body and soul. Not long ago, there was even one leader who asked his followers to commit suicide, and they obeyed. Since on Earth they love proof, there is an excellent one to give them. Universal law forbids suicide. If this master had been genuine, he would have known this. In demanding this sacrifice from them, he presented the greatest proof of his ignorance. Sects and religions are a curse on Earth, and when you see that the Pope sets aside millions of francs or dollars for his travel, when he could make do with much less, and use what money is available to help countries suffering from famine, you cannot persuade me that it is the word of Christ which directs such actions. There is a passage in your Bible that says, it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter paradise. The Vatican is certainly the wealthiest church on your planet, and yet the priests have made vows of poverty. They have no fear of being damned, yet they believe in damnation, because they say it is the church which is rich, not them. This is really just a play on words, since they make up the church. It's like the son of a multi-billionaire claiming that he is not rich, only his father is. The church has not distorted the passage in the Bible relating to wealth. They have used it to their advantage, for isn't it preferable that the rich grow poorer at the profit of the church? The young generations on Earth are in the process of self-examination. They have come to a turning point, events have led them to it, and I know that they feel alone, more than any younger generation has before them. It isn't by joining sects or religious groups that they are going to be free of their solitude. First, if you want to elevate yourself, you must meditate and then concentrate, which is different, although often the two are confused. You do not need to go to a special place, for the greatest and most beautiful temple of man is inside himself. There, he can enter into communication with his higher self, by concentration, asking his higher self to help him surmount his earthly, material difficulties. But certain people need to communicate with other human beings, like themselves, and they can meet together for this purpose. Those who are more experienced will be able to give advice, but no one should ever adopt a position as master. The master came 2,000 years ago, or rather, I should say, one of the masters, but men crucified him. However, for approximately 300 of your years, the message he brought with him was followed. After that, it was distorted and now, on earth, you have returned to a point that is worse than that of 2,000 years ago. The young generation of whom I have just spoken, are rising up on your planet and realizing, little by little, the truth of many of the things I have been talking about. But they must learn to look inside themselves for their answers. They should not wait for help to come to them from elsewhere, or they will be disappointed.
May you be healthy and strong. May you be free from fear, filled with love. We can be peaceful and happy. We can be healthy and strong. We can be free from fear, filled with love. Peace is what our planet needs. Peace that plants a gentle seed of love and truth in word and deed, overcoming fear and greed. Peace is what our planet needs. Peace that plants a gentle seed of love and truth in word and deed, overcoming hate and greed. And we can be peaceful and happy. We can be healthy and strong. We can be free from fear, filled with
Lily Fraser, and may you be peaceful and happy. So that brings to an end our story of Michel Demarque and his abduction to the ninth planet. We'll now go on to something completely different. Is it time for us to get back to nature?
You've touched a tree before. You touched it and walked away. Something you could not see and could not feel started inside your body the moment your hand met that bark. And it was still going 7 days later. And the thing you touched is not what you think it is. The question nobody asks is why. What is a tree doing to your body without a single chemical pill? The answer involves what wood is actually made of, what is happening underneath every forest floor, and why the oldest living thing on Earth has never aged a single day. Hold your hand out in front of you. Look at your fingertips. You have touched thousands of things today. A doorknob, a coffee cup, your phone, the fabric of your clothes. You have never touched a single one of them. Not once in your entire life. The electron clouds around the atoms in your skin repel the electron clouds in everything you reach for. Electromagnetic force pushes back across a gap that never closes. What you feel as contact is force across empty space. Every texture you have ever known, every handshake, every surface you have pressed your palm against. Electromagnetic repulsion. Your brain interprets the force as touch. But the gap is always there. So when you put your hand on a tree, your skin does not meet the bark. But something does cross that gap, not through contact, through the air between you. And the physics of what crosses that gap is the first thing nobody ever explains. Trees release molecules into the air around them, not occasionally, constantly. Constantly. These are volatile organic compounds, molecules with low enough molecular mass and high enough vapor pressure to transition from liquid to gas at ordinary temperatures and atmospheric pressure. That is a physics threshold, not a biology one. Whether a molecule becomes airborne depends on intermolecular forces, how tightly the molecules grip each other. Below a certain molecular weight and above a certain vapor pressure, the molecule escapes into the gas phase, alpha pinene, beta pinene, D-limonene, 1,8-cineol. These molecules are light enough and loosely bound enough to float. They have a name, phytoncides, and that word does not mean what people selling essential oils want you to think it means. It was coined in 1928 by a Russian biologist named Boris Tokin, and it literally translates to exterminated by the plant. These are chemical defense weapons. Trees manufacture them to kill bacteria, fungi, and insects that threaten the tree's survival. The tree is not releasing pleasant aromas. It is waging chemical warfare on everything small enough to be destroyed by airborne molecules. Here is the physics that matters. Once these molecules enter the gas phase, they follow the same rules every gas follows. Fick's law of diffusion. Molecules move from regions of high concentration to regions of low concentration along a gradient. The tree is the source. Maximum concentration at the bark surface. The air around the tree is the gradient field. Concentration drops with distance according to an inverse relationship. 1 hectare of pine forest, about 2.5 acres, releases roughly 5 kilograms of phytoncides into the air every single day. 5 kilograms of antimicrobial molecules diffusing outward, sterilizing the atmosphere as they go. Forest air contains 200 to 300 bacterial cells per cubic meter. City air contains thousands. The diffusion field around the tree is, in a measurable sense, a sterilization zone. When you stand near a tree, you are standing inside this diffusion cloud. When you touch the bark, you are at the point of maximum concentration. Your lungs pull roughly 6 to 8 liters of air per minute at rest. Each breath carries these molecules across the thin membrane of your alveoli and into your bloodstream. The physics is simple. Gas phase diffusion into a low-pressure biological system. The consequences are not simple at all. Once these molecules cross into your lungs, something measurable happens. In 2009, a research team led by Dr. Ching Li at Nippon Medical School in Tokyo exposed human subjects to phytoncides and measured what happened to their immune cells over the following weeks. Natural killer cells. A specific class of lymphocyte whose function is to identify and destroy tumor cells and virus-infected cells showed significantly increased activity. Not for hours, not for a day. The increase in natural killer cell activity lasted more than 7 days from a single exposure. Extended exposure over 2 or 3 days in a forest produced effects lasting more than 30 days. The same studies measured adrenaline and noradrenaline concentrations in subjects' urine and found significant reductions. The stress hormones that drive your fight or flight response physically decreased in the presence of these diffusing molecules. Think about that. Molecular compounds following a concentration gradient through an air gap, entering through the respiratory system, and altering the behavior of specific immune cells for weeks. Not relaxation. Not fresh air. Not placebo. Physics. Diffusion physics. Delivering a measurable biological result. But there is a second mechanism operating through the same tree at the same time. Electron transfer. A tree is an electrical conductor. Its root system is in direct contact with the Earth's surface, which carries a net negative charge, a charge maintained by the global electrical circuit driven by roughly 2,000 active thunderstorms happening at any given moment around the planet. When your conductive skin contacts a grounded conductor, charge flows. Electrons move from the Earth through the tree into your body. A study published in 2013 measured what this does to human blood. Grounding increased the zeta potential on red blood cells, the electrical charge on the cell surface that determines how strongly cells repel one another. Higher zeta potential means your red blood cells spread apart rather than clumping. A measurable change in blood viscosity from electron transfer through a tree trunk connected to the ground beneath your feet. There is a third layer, and this one is a trick your own nervous system plays on you. Thermal conductivity. Wood conducts heat roughly 1,000 times more slowly than metal. When you wrap your hand around a metal railing on a cold morning, the metal rips heat from your skin. It feels freezing. Wood does not do this. Your hand stays warm, and your brain reads that warmth as comfort, as the object giving you something. But the tree is not giving you warmth. It is simply failing to take it. Your nervous system cannot distinguish between an object that provides heat and an object that does not conduct it away. Thermophysics creating a neurological illusion of warmth that has nothing to do with the tree and everything to do with conductivity coefficients. So, three physics mechanisms: molecular diffusion delivering antimicrobial compounds along concentration gradients, electron transfer modifying blood cell charge through a grounded conductor, thermal conductivity generating an illusion of comfort in the somatosensory cortex, all measurable, all operating through the air gap between your skin and the bark. Not metaphor. Physics. Now I want you to think about the tree itself. You have been thinking about what it does to you. Think about what it actually is. A mature oak weighs around 10,000 pounds. Conservation of mass, one of the oldest principles in physics, says that weight came from somewhere. Every atom in that trunk existed before the tree did. So where did 10,000 pounds come from? Well, the obvious answer is the soil. Roots go deep, pull material up, material becomes tree. That feels right. And a man named John Baptist Van Helmont thought so too. In 1648, he designed one of the most elegant experiments in the history of biology. He dried 200 pounds of soil in an oven, weighed it precisely, and placed it in a large earthen pot. He planted a 5-pound willow sapling. Then he covered the pot with a perforated tin lid to keep out dust and airborne debris. For 5 years. 5 years! He watered that tree with nothing but rainwater or distilled water. He kept the system controlled. He was meticulous. When he finally uprooted the tree and weighed everything, the willow had grown to 169 pounds. It had gained 164 pounds of solid mass, bark, wood, roots, branches. He dried the soil and weighed it again. It had lost less than 2 ounces. 164 pounds of mass had appeared, and it had not come from the soil. Van Helmont concluded it must have come from the water. Reasonable guess. Water was the only thing he added. But think about this more carefully. Water is H2O, hydrogen, and oxygen. Hydrogen is the lightest element in the universe. One proton, one electron, almost no mass at all. And wood. The hard, dense structural material of a tree is made of carbon. Carbon is the heavier atom. 6 protons, 6 neutrons, 6 electrons. Roughly 50% of the dry weight of any tree is carbon atoms. Not hydrogen, not oxygen. Carbon. Where is the carbon coming from? Not from water. Water contains no carbon. Not from soil. The soil barely changed. All the minerals a tree pulls from the ground, calcium, potassium, magnesium, phosphorus, iron, together account for only 1 to 2% of total dry mass. Trace amounts. The water contributed hydrogen and oxygen, yes. But the carbon, the bulk of the tree, the thing that makes wood hard and dense and structural, did not come from water and did not come from soil. Van Helmont had eliminated 2 answers. He was stuck. And the right answer was, in the most literal sense, surrounding him. So where did it come from? This is a genuine physics puzzle, and the answer is one of the most beautiful in all of science. It came from a gas, carbon dioxide, CO2, a molecule that makes up just 0.04% of the atmosphere. An invisible trace gas hanging in the air around Van Helmont's experiment the entire time he was running it. Trees pull carbon dioxide through tiny pores on their leaves called stomata. Inside the leaf, they strip the carbon atom from the CO2 molecule, chain those carbon atoms together into glucose, C6H12O6, and release the leftover oxygen. That released oxygen is your breathing air. Every breath you take exists because a tree somewhere stripped carbon from the atmosphere and discarded the oxygen as waste. But the mechanism of that stripping, this is where the physics is remarkable. Put your hand on the nearest wooden surface right now. A desk. A doorframe. A shelf. What you are touching was assembled by starlight. Sunlight is electromagnetic radiation, traveling at 300 million meters per second from a star 93 million miles away. When a photon of the right wavelength, roughly 400 to 700 nanometers, the visible spectrum strikes a chlorophyll molecule in a leaf, it kicks an electron to a higher energy state. That electron has absorbed the photon's energy. It is now unstable, excited, carrying more energy than it should. It enters an electron transport chain, a sequence of molecular machines embedded in the membrane of the chloroplast, and its energy is extracted step by step to build ATP, the universal energy molecule of biology. That ATP then powers the most thermodynamically improbable reaction in the living world, breaking apart carbon dioxide. CO2 is one of the most stable small molecules in nature. The bond between carbon and oxygen is strong. It takes real energy to tear it apart. The ATP provides that energy. The carbon atom is freed from its oxygen partners, and the tree forges it into glucose through new electromagnetic bonds. Carbon to carbon to carbon to carbon. A chain, a structure, a solid. Glucose becomes cellulose, long repeating chains of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen that form the structural walls of every plant cell. Cellulose becomes reinforced with lignin, a harder, more complex carbon polymer that fills the gaps between cellulose fibers and gives wood its rigidity and its resistance to compression. Electromagnetic energy from a star, captured by a pigment molecule, converted to chemical bond energy holding carbon atoms in fixed positions. That is not a metaphor. That is the molecular mechanism. Photon energy in, solid matter out. A 10,000-pound oak is solidified air. Crystallized atmosphere, built atom by atom from an invisible gas, assembled by captured starlight. Conservation of mass and conservation of energy, both satisfied. Here is the part of this story that I find poignant. Van Helmont. The man who designed that beautiful experiment, the man who proved definitively that the mass did not come from soil, spent years trying to figure out where it went. And the answer was floating invisibly in front of his face the entire time. But here is the twist that makes the story extraordinary. Van Helmont coined the word gas. He derived it from the Greek word chaos to describe the invisible vapors he kept encountering in his chemical experiments. He was the first person in history to recognize that there were different kinds of invisible air, that carbon dioxide was a distinct substance, different from regular atmosphere. He invented the word for the very thing that held his answer, and he still missed it. The man who named gases could not see that a gas was building his tree. Think about that. Every plank of wood in your house, every page of every book you have ever held, every forest on this planet, all of it was once invisible carbon dioxide drifting through the atmosphere. When you touch a tree, you are touching centuries of electromagnetic energy from a star, locked into chemical bonds between carbon atoms pulled from thin air. Here is what that means for you, right now. Every breath you exhale contains carbon dioxide, CO2, leaving your lungs. Some of those carbon atoms were once part of food you ate, which was once a plant, which pulled those atoms from the air, which got those atoms from air. You are exhaling atoms that have been through this cycle before. The carbon in your breath was once a tree, or a blade of grass, or a fern 300 million years old, and a tree you are standing next to right now is pulling some of those atoms back in through its leaves, stripping the carbon, building it into wood. You are breathing out what the tree is breathing in. You are part of the same carbon cycle, the same physics, the same conservation law, running in opposite directions. But you have been thinking about this tree as if it were standing alone, a single organism, a solitary thing rooted in one place. It is not. And this is where the story changes. In the early 1990s, a young forest ecologist named Suzanne Simard was working for the British Columbia Ministry of Forests. Her job was to help improve forestry practices, specifically figuring out how to make replanted clear cuts grow faster. The standard practice at the time was to strip everything, cut the commercial trees, bulldoze the remaining vegetation, plant rows of Douglas fir seedlings in clean soil, and the seedlings kept dying. Nobody could figure out why. They had sunlight, water, soil, space. Everything a tree should need. But they died at rates far higher than seedlings growing in natural forests with all the trees around them. Simard had an idea that her colleagues did not take seriously. She suspected the seedlings were dying because they had been cut off from something underground, something connecting them to all the trees. She proposed that trees in a natural forest were sharing resources through fungal networks in the soil, and that the clear-cut seedlings were starving because the network had been destroyed. Now, you have to understand how this sounded in the 1990s. The prevailing model of forest ecology was competition. Trees compete for light, water, nutrients. The forest is an arena, every tree for itself. The idea that trees were cooperating, sharing carbon, feeding each other, sounded like mysticism, not science. Simard was dismissed. She has talked openly about senior colleagues telling her this work would end her career. She designed the experiment anyway. She went into the forest with plastic bags, syringes, a Geiger counter, and two different radioactive isotopes of carbon, carbon-14 and carbon-13. She covered individual birch and fir seedlings with sealed bags, injected air containing the radioactive CO2, and let the trees photosynthesize the labeled carbon into their tissues. Then she waited. Hours passed. She moved to the neighboring trees, trees that had been growing nearby but had never been exposed to either tracer gas, and tested their tissues with the Geiger counter. The counter clicked. Radioactive carbon was inside trees that had never been given any. Carbon was flowing between trees through underground pathways, not through the air. She had sealed the system. Not through soil water. The isotope signatures were wrong for that. Through something physical, something structural, connecting root system to root system beneath the surface. Simard has described the moment she saw the Geiger counter respond on an unexposed tree. She knew right then. The network was real. The pathways are mycorrhizal networks. Fungal threads, hyphae, thinner than a human hair, that grow from the tips of tree roots and extend outward through the soil, connecting one tree's root system to another's. A single fungal network can span an entire forest. One teaspoon of healthy forest soil contains miles of these threads, a density of connection that makes the network remarkably robust. Now, the topology of these connections resembles what network scientists call a scale-free network, a mathematical structure where a few nodes have enormous numbers of connections while most nodes have few. The same architecture found in the internet, in airline route maps, in the neural connections of a brain. The oldest, largest trees are the hubs, the highest degree nodes. The younger trees are the peripheral nodes connected to them. Kevin Baylor, one of Simard's graduate students, used DNA analysis to map the physical connections in an entire Douglas fir forest. Virtually every tree was linked. The network was not scattered patches of connection. It was one continuous web, and the traffic flowing through this network is not trivial. Paper birch and Douglas fir exchange carbon seasonally. In summer, when young Douglas fir are shaded by the canopy and struggling to photosynthesize, birch trees send carbon through the fungal connections to sustain them. In winter, when birch has dropped its leaves and cannot make sugar, fir returns the favor. The network redistributes resources from surplus to deficit, a kind of equilibration across connected nodes driven by concentration gradients. The same diffusion physics that governs the phyton sides in the air governs the carbon flow underground. But it is not just nutrients. Chemical signals propagate through the network. When a Douglas fir is attacked by insects and sustains tissue damage, it releases defense compounds into the mycorrhizal network. Neighboring trees, including different species connected through the same fungal web, begin producing defense enzymes before the insects have reached them. Information transmitted through a physical substrate, not light, not sound. Chemistry traveling through fungal fiber in the dark beneath the forest floor. The oldest trees in a forest, Simard calls them mother trees, function as the highest degree nodes in the network. They have the most fungal connections, the most resource flow, and they do something that surprised even Simard. They recognize their own offspring. Using DNA analysis, her team mapped which seedlings received the most carbon from which mature trees. Mother trees sent significantly more carbon to genetically related seedlings than to unrelated ones growing at the same distance. They also adjusted their root architecture, physically pulling back their own roots to make space for their seedlings to establish. And when a mother tree is dying, when disease or damage is killing it, it dumps its carbon reserves into the network. A massive pulse of resources pushed outward to the connected trees before the hub goes offline. A final act of distribution from a dying node. Think about that. A tree that recognizes its offspring, feeds them preferentially, makes physical space for them, and when it dies, sends everything it has left into the network for the others. Simard's work has been debated. Some researchers argue the scale and significance of network communication may be overstated in popular accounts, and they have published critiques. Simard and others have published detailed responses. This is how science refines itself: claim, test, counterclaim, new data. But the core finding rests on solid experimental evidence. Trees connect underground through fungal networks. Carbon, water, nutrients, and chemical signals move between them. The network is real. Now, when you touch a single tree, you are not touching an individual. You are touching a node in a distributed system that extends beneath your feet in every direction. The forest floor is a web of biological fiber carrying mass and information between organisms that have been connected for centuries. I told you at the beginning that the oldest living thing on Earth has never aged a single day. Let me tell you what I mean. In the White Mountains of California, in a harsh landscape of wind-scoured rock and thin air, there is a bristlecone pine named Methuselah. It is 4,857 years old. It was a living tree when the Egyptian pyramids were under construction. It has been photosynthesizing continuously through the rise and fall of every civilization in recorded human history. The United States Forest Service keeps its exact location secret because they are afraid of what people might do to it if they could find it. There was another bristlecone pine. It was even older, at least 4,862 years, possibly over 5,000. In 1964, a geography graduate student named Donald Curry was studying glacial history in eastern Nevada. He was coring bristlecone pines to count their growth rings for climate data, standard dendrochronology. His increment borer got stuck in one particular tree. The tool jammed and he could not extract it. He asked the United States Forest Service for permission to cut the tree down to retrieve his equipment and get a sample. They said yes, he cut it down. And only after he began counting the growth rings on the stump, painstakingly, ring by ring, working inward from bark to heartwood, did he realize what he had done. The count went past 1,000, past 2,000, past 3,000, past 4,000. He had destroyed the oldest known living organism on Earth. Nearly 5,000 years of continuous life. A tree that had been photosynthesizing since before the invention of writing, since before the wheel, since before any human civilization that still exists, ended because a coring tool got stuck and a bureaucrat signed a permission slip. Curry never fully recovered from it. He rarely spoke about the incident for the rest of his career. Let that settle. Now, these trees survived not by being strong. They survived by being mostly dead. Bristlecone pines use something called sectored architecture. At any given time, only a narrow strip of bark on the tree is alive, a thin ribbon of living cambium connecting a small section of roots to a handful of green needles. 95% of the tree is dead wood, but that dead wood is so dense and so saturated with resin that it does not rot. It erodes like stone, worn down by wind and ice over millennia, rather than consumed by bacteria. The needles stay on the branches for 40 years, conserving the energy that other trees spend regrowing leaves every spring. The tree sacrificed nearly all of itself to keep a sliver alive. Now here's the question that matters. Why don't trees age? You age. Every animal ages. Right now, as you listen to this, your telomeres, the protective caps on the ends of your chromosomes, are shorter than they were 10 years ago. Every time one of your cells divides, those caps get a little shorter. Your DNA is accumulating copying errors with every division. Your cells are gradually losing the ability to replicate accurately. This is programmed senescence. It is not a disease. It is a feature built into animal biology. You have a clock inside every cell in your body, and it is counting down. Trees do not have this clock. Their meristematic cells, the dividing cells at the tips of every root and branch, replicate indefinitely. The cambium layer, that thin ring of living tissue just beneath the bark, produces fresh wood and fresh bark every year without degradation. Researchers studying ancient bristlecone pines found something remarkable: telomerase activity, the enzyme that rebuilds telomeres. The very thing that wears down in your cells was higher in the oldest trees than in young ones. The older the tree, the more actively it maintained its chromosomes. The cells of a 5,000-year-old bristlecone pine show no molecular indication of knowing how old they are. So what kills them? Stand up for a moment if you can. Feel your weight pressing into the floor through your feet. Feel gravity pulling straight down through your body. Now imagine that force, but amplified by 10,000 pounds of mass, pulling water 300 feet straight up from roots to crown through columns thinner than a drinking straw. Physics kills them. Not biology. Physics. Wind force scales with surface area, and surface area increases with the square of height. A tree twice as tall catches four times the wind load. In a storm, the bending moment at the base of the trunk increases not just with wind speed, but with the lever arm of the entire crown acting at height. Taller trees don't just catch more wind, they amplify the force through mechanical leverage. Water transport through the xylem, the narrow columns of dead cells that pull water upward purely by tension, no pump, no heart, just the cohesive force of water molecules gripping each other in an unbroken chain from root to leaf, requires increasingly extreme negative pressure as the tree grows taller. At 100 feet, the system is already under significant tension. At 300 feet, the negative pressure approaches what physicists call the cavitation limit, the point where the water literally tears apart, dissolved gases form bubbles, the column breaks, and the transport line fails. This is why the tallest trees on Earth, coast redwoods at roughly 380 feet, are near the theoretical maximum. Not because their biology cannot grow taller, because the physics of water under tension will not permit it. And then there is the square cube law. Mass scales with the cube of height. Cross-sectional strength of the trunk scales only with the square. Every inch of growth makes the structure proportionally weaker relative to its own weight. Eventually, the physics accumulates. Lightning finds the tallest point. Wind catches the largest surface. Drought breaks the water columns. Insects exploit the first wound. Fire sweeps through. The structure fails. But the cells, the living, dividing cells in the cambium, those were fine. Those would have kept going. The biology did not fail. The engineering did. The bristlecone pine solved this by refusing to grow. Staying small. Growing slowly, sometimes less than an inch of new wood per century. Sacrificing height and mass and surface area to minimize wind load, minimize water transport demands, minimize structural stress. It traded scale for time. And it worked for almost 5,000 years until a graduate student's tool got stuck. There is something very interesting about this. Every tree on Earth is caught between two forces. Its biology wants to keep going. Cells dividing, cambium growing, life continuing without any internal limit. But its physics is a countdown. Every ring of growth adds mass, adds height, adds surface area, brings the structure one increment closer to the scaling limit where something external will destroy it. Trees are biologically immortal organisms living inside structures that physics will eventually break. Stand next to any tree and think about what you now know. What you're really standing next to. You're touching solidified air. Carbon atoms pulled from the atmosphere and forged into chemical bonds by electromagnetic energy captured from a star 93 million miles away. The wood under your hand is centuries of starlight made solid. And right now, without you feeling a thing, three physics mechanisms are operating on your body through the gap between your skin and that bark. Molecular diffusion is delivering antimicrobial compounds along a concentration gradient, compounds that will alter your natural killer cell activity for the next 7 days. Electrons are flowing from the ground through the trunk into your body, modifying the electrical charge on your red blood cells. And your brain is registering warmth that does not exist. A thermal illusion created by low conductivity coefficients that your nervous system has no way to distinguish from real warmth. Beneath your feet, a scale-free network of fungal threads connects this tree to every other tree around it, redistributing carbon and chemical signals through a web that was operating before you were born and will continue after you are gone. The tree you are touching is not an individual, it is a node. It recognizes its offspring. It feeds them through the network. And when it is dying, it will send everything it has left into the system for the others. And the tree itself, the living cells in its cambium, may be functionally immortal, dividing without degradation. Telomeres rebuilding. No biological clock, no expiration. Limited, not by aging, not by disease, not by any failure of its own cells, but by the square cube law, by wind force, by the cavitation limit of water under tension 300 feet above the ground. Physics writes the death certificate for every tree on Earth. Never biology. You touched a tree once. You touched it and walked away and you thought nothing had changed. Everything had changed. You just could not see it. Neither could Van Helmont, the man who invented the word for what he could not see, who held the answer in the air around him for 5 years and never recognized it. You know, a flower does not become less beautiful when you understand the physics. It becomes something more. And the same is true for every tree you have ever walked past without stopping. Touch one tomorrow. Not because it is spiritual, because it is physics.
Plant a tree for your tomorrow. It's your tree that clears the air. Plant a tree, trees for America. Plant a tree today for all the world to share. Taste the breezes, life inside you. Make a promise to the earth. Plant a tree, now is the time to recognize a tree for all that it is worth.
Plant a tree for your tomorrow.
It's your tree that clears the air. Plant a tree, trees for America. Plant a tree today for all the world to share. Make a place for birds to sing. Plant a forest for the future, where the breath of life begins with every spring. Plant a tree for your tomorrow. It's your tree that clears the air. Plant a tree, trees for America. Plant a tree today for all the world to share.
The late, great John Denver, of course. Now we're going to hear from Lee Harris and Collective Consciousness.
Collective Restlessness and agitation rising. So, disillusionment in our systems and our leadership is at an all-time low. But so too is the energy drive in people to survive and help build a better world. The restlessness and agitation in the air will build to change. A world is being built around us currently with technology, control, and systems that need to have humanity's best interests in them. As that path increases, the wheels of that system will continue to fall off because they aren't building much of it with humanity's best interests at heart. But it will require more of us being advocates of a more compassionate world. So the message here is, there's a couple of messages in this one. Collective restlessness and agitation rising. I think you can feel that everywhere. I think you can see and perceive it in people, in their faces, in how they're reacting. So reactivity is something we've talked about during these times. People get very reactive. So give people grace and space. It's understandably a time that brings a lot to the surface for people. But equally, the restlessness and agitation will build to change. This is not useless energy. This is energy that is supposed to stir unease or a desire for something else in us so that we move it forward when the time comes. And we will know. We will know when the time comes for us to step forward, use our voice, take an action. It may not be today, but you might be feeling the restlessness and the agitation rising in you. So as an inhuman path continues to build itself, the wheels of that system will continue to fall off, but it will require more of us being advocates of a more compassionate world. Now, that compassionate world is not just about feelings. You know, there are those of you who might be helping spread compassion in the world. There are people developing technologies that are to create a more compassionate system, meaning inclusive for all. So it shows up in different ways and different roles. Final two themes we have. Ignoring reality or creating a new one. Ignoring reality or creating a new one. The overwhelm of information right now can lead to many of us needing to step away from all the news headlines and our access to seeing disaster headlines everywhere. Now, for some, it's fine to be connected to it all and they can watch unaffected. In fact, many people use it to study what's going on, which is great. It's okay to follow your truth if you are one who needs to step away or are choosing to look less. But equally, if you're doing that, focus on what you are creating that is different. Different experiences, different ways of being, different ways of creating or serving in the world. This will balance the need to step back. So if you are someone who previously was very much into servicing everyone's feelings or always watching the headlines to see what was going on in the world, and just those are just two examples, and you feel overwhelmed by all of that, it's great if you know you need to step back, but you will need to create something else in its place. And you will need to be tapping in on what it is that you can do and be now. That's really the nature of this time. You know, we're at this accelerated time, yes. But in many ways, for a lot of us, it's kind of back to basics in an interesting way. Many of us are being called back into our souls, into who we are, who our true selves are, before we got lost in the system. So it kind of goes back to the restlessness and agitation theme. There is this energy brewing that, as I started the whole energy update, there are some people who are already running with it. And then there are others who it's moving through your system, but you don't feel readied yet. You are still readying yourself. So it's okay to follow your truth in stepping away or choosing to look less. I think that's important because I've seen, you know, and heard certain people annoyed at people who are choosing not to look, and they go, well, you need to look to be informed. And I don't think that's true. I think we all have to mind our own business about who we are. And some people I know can look at news headlines very technically and they process it very mentally. Some sensitives and empaths I know, it's overwhelming. You read the story and you feel the story and you feel the horror moving through your body. And until we get better mainstream media that isn't so focused on the negative and the fear-based, it's very hard to see that as a true representation of reality, particularly when for all of us, you know, there might be people in your life right now who are really accessing high frequencies in themselves because they're walking the forest every day and they're taking care of themselves. But if you just subject yourself to that narrative all the time, it's more than most people can handle or deal with, because now we are bombarded with information from everywhere. So again, if you are overwhelmed, think and act local for a while. It doesn't mean ignore the rest of the world in terms of your compassion or love or support for the world, but you might need to just make your world a bit smaller so that your nervous system can reset. But do create a new reality if you're choosing to step away from paying attention to the bigger reality that you used to follow. Okay, final theme. And I think in a way, yeah, this final theme kind of wraps it all up. People power. We are powering up. People power. We are powering up. By unplugging from who and how we used to be, and by outer world events forcing us to change and pivot. You might be feeling pulled in many directions on the timeline right now as you recalibrate. So you might be feeling pulled in yourself. You know, you might be going through such an awakening process around your own life, your own history, your own desires, your own goals, and feeling so much change inside yourself. Because the world that many of us grew up in and knew is rapidly shifting, it does create a relay effect inside the self. So for many of us, I think we're all unplugging from aspects of who we used to be at rapid speed. And it can sometimes create disorientation. I spoke in the April energy update last month about dimensional disorientation, feeling like you're between worlds, between states of consciousness, between old identities and new identities. It's quite normal. But we are powering up through that process. You have to shed to become. You have to shed an old skin to become a new version of yourself. So people power, we are powering up. You might feel very powerful in yourself in new ways right now, and you might feel the most vulnerable you've ever felt, but it's a process. So as ever, get the support you need. Look to the light wherever you can find it, the people, the places, the things that connect you, the experiences that connect you. So many of us grew up thinking our sensitivity was a problem. We were told we were different, we were not normal, or we were told there was something wrong with us just by people who didn't understand, who weren't having the same experience. Sensitivity isn't the problem. Not understanding your sensitivity is. Sensitivity is being recognized more as a superpower and a part of our wiring. Many of you are here to seed the consciousness of sensitivity back unto the earth.
I am Barry. It's been The Voice Within. Kakite, shalom, namaste, masalam. May your God go with you.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.